Today it's a real treat to have another colleague from MSU. The History Department is the fount of all good things that come from MSU, as you well know. And Professor Calvert and I go way, way back to when we had a joint old-fashioned land-grant apartment, the Department of History, Philosophy, Government, and Religious Studies. And we finally hatched political science out of that mess. And Jerry was one of the keystone folks in building that department. His specific interests in political science were state and local government. And the result is that he knows about as much about state and local government. Maybe he knows. He can't sleep at night very well. But what he's going to address today is the subject of reapportionment, the gerrymandering or lack of gerrymandering that may have come from that, the role of finance in campaigns, and issues associated with the most important political act of our year, which is our election. Jerry will speak for about a half hour or so, and then open up for all of your questions. But if you have something really urgent, stand up and yell at him, and he'll probably answer it right away. It's a real pleasure and an honor to introduce Jerry.
All right. As Pierce pointed out, my lead topic is to talk about legislative districting, because apparently that's a topic that people want to hear about. But there are other issues we need to talk about that bear not only in Montana, but also on the national election this year and in coming years that need to be addressed. And I'll try to frame all that. I will frame all that in about a half hour, if less, and then we'll just open it up to whatever you want to talk about. Rules in politics as in sports are never neutral. Witness the changes in sports football rules and basketball rules and so on if you follow sports. And of course, in sports, the object is to create a fair and competitive system, although there are other kinds of motives going on. As I told students at MSU, you look at the U.S. Constitution, Bill of Rights, legislation. Some of these activities are designed with the best of intentions to be fair to all and so forth and so on. And others, not so much, but they're always called fair for everyone. So I want to talk about that and keep in mind rules are not neutral. Okay. Now, let's spend a little bit of time on legislative districting. And for some of you know this already, and some of you probably don't, but let's just start with the basics. Until the mid-1960s, legislative districting for Congress and state legislatures and other elective offices were under the authority of state legislatures in most cases. And quite frankly, state legislatures often didn't even reapportion congressional districts or state legislative districts based on the census. And so in 1964 and 65, the U.S. Supreme Court stepped in and handed down two fundamental decisions establishing the principle of one person, one vote. That means that the districting authority, still mostly the state legislature in most states, is obliged after each 10-year census to take those census numbers and end up drawing districts for the Congress, for the state legislature, as equal in population as technically possible. Okay. Now, that's still the rule. Please understand, that's the rule. Now, the Supreme Court of the United States has laid down two supplementary rules to that. One is they've been very harsh on any congressional districting plan that even exceeds 1% variation from the largest to the smallest congressional district. On the other hand, they've been a little more liberal, I use that term, for lesser districts like state legislative districts. So here's the rule of Montana. State legislative districts may not vary across the 100 House district and 50 Senate districts more than 3% plus or minus from the largest and smallest district. That's the rule. Okay, and that's the rule they apply. That's it. And that's our problem. That's our problem. The Supreme Court has had two opportunities in the last two decades to say, gee, sure, your districts are equal in population, but my God, look at what you did. You you packed that minority party in a few districts as possible and gave yourself a permanent majority for the next 10 years. They have consistently said, no, we don't want to deal with that. That's our area. We're not going to deal with that. And the consequences are very predictable in light of the 2010 census, if you're paying attention. In states, about 40 states, where the state legislators do the line drawing, the majority party draws the lines in their favor. And they can do that constitutionally at the present, as long as they end up with districts based on the principle of one person, one vote. So you can gerrymander like the Dickens. You can draw all kinds of goofy-looking districts. You can do all that stuff, and they do. Now, here's the other thing. The Republican Party understood this, whereas Democrats, always one step behind, frankly, in a lot of areas, didn't get it. And so they made a determined effort to gain seats in state legislatures in the 2010 election, because they knew if we control the process, it's gangbusters, we can go do it. And they did, okay? The result is an anomaly in election history. In the 2012 U.S. House elections, the first one under the new reapportionment schemes in the states, the Republican Party took 234 seats of 210 for the Democrats, one undecided, and yet they lost the popular vote nationwide by 1.5 million votes. That never happens in this kind of system. The majority party, the party that gets the majority of seats in Congress, always gets a majority or the largest plurality of the popular vote nationwide, often by a good number, 2 or 3 percentage points. This tells you something, okay? If you look at, I haven't seen the numbers, so I'm just going to guesstimate here. If you look at the 435 congressional races up for grabs this November, I'm willing to bet not more than 30 are really competitive. That either party could possibly win it, given other things being equal. There's no salvation in the Supreme Court for egregious partisan gerrymandering that always assigns a minority party to a permanent minority status for at least 10 years. So what to do about it? Again, here's our solution in our system. We have a federal system, which means 50 states. That means each state can decide how they want to do it, given the rules, and who should do it. And so about 10 states, including Montana, as you know, take it away from politicians and give it to an independent commission. And I know there's been a little bit of partisan back and forth over the years about the Montana Reapportionment Districting Commission, composed of 5 individuals, 2 selected by Republican leaders in the legislature, 2 by Democrats. They have 20 days to pick the chair. If they don't pick the chair, the state Supreme Court does. And usually that chair is always the 3-2 vote on contentious issues. And so there's like a bickering about that person's leaning one way or the other, blah, blah, blah. It's a good system. It's a good system. California has a little different system. They have a larger independent commission. They got so tired of gerrymandering. The Democrats are doing it in California, by the way, that they took it away from the state legislature and gave it to, I think, a 15-person commission. One-third Democrat, one-third Republican, one-third independent, private citizens. And they're aided by professional staff who give them the numbers. We should have that. I'll just stop right there. I want to talk about something that happens every 2 years, which is voting, which has been my specialty over the years, among other things. I've written several things on this. And I'm going to take this in 2 parts, because they both involve 3, in my judgment, extremely bad Supreme Court decisions in the last 2 or 3 years. In 1965, Lyndon Johnson vigorously pushed for, and signed the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act, as I've told MSU students over the many years, is one of the few acts of Congress I could point to and say, boy, that worked. You know, that really did what it intended. It created space for minority voters in the Deep South to vote without getting killed. Okay? And so with that in mind, the Voting Rights Act did some wonderful things. It led to a dramatic increase in minority voting in the Deep South, a dramatic increase in the number of minority candidates elected to public office. And that's still the case. There's unintended consequence of the Voting Rights Act, which President Johnson knew about, and he talked to Bill Moyers about it, but no one else knew about it. He said to Bill Moyers, who was press secretary at the time, he says, because of the Voting Rights Act, we're going to lose the South. Because whites will flee the Democratic Party, and they did and have. The result, of course, today is a realignment in politics in which the probably the hardest, most solid base of the Republican Party are the states of the Deep South. No doubt about it. Okay. So, years go by and years go by. The Voting Rights Act, the most contentious part of the Voting Rights Act, was preclearance. That any covered jurisdiction under Section 4 of the Act must pre-clear any election law changes with the U.S. Department of Justice, whose inquiry is whether this change would, in fact, dilute minority voting strength. Now, who are the covered jurisdictions? All the states of the Deep South, plus counties in several other states, including a couple in Montana, that are contiguous with Indian reservations. Okay? So, one might ask, contemporarily, well, how many election law changes were rejected by the Justice Department over those decades till the present? Far less than 1%. One might also ask, in 2013-2014, do we still have a problem with state and local officials who have authority to make election law changes and decisions? Are they still messing around here? Yes, they are. Including in Shelby County. I'll come back to that. So let me talk about this law. Section 5, preclearance. Section 4, the jurisdictions established as covered under the Act. In Shelby County v. Holter, the Supreme Court, by 5-4, essentially gutted the Voting Rights Act, or at least partially gutted the Voting Rights Act, in which Justice Roberts said, with some justification, I think, well, Section 4 covered jurisdictions. The Congress, when it reauthorized the Act a few years ago, should have looked at that and thought about, well, should we take some out and put some in? Should we, you know, this is not 1964-65. Fair point. He could have also said, in my judgment, gee, Congress must know what they're doing here because they passed this sucker overwhelmingly in both houses. They must think it's important to continue this. But he didn't do that. Okay. What Shelby County did was do with preclearance. Left intact, you might want to fix Section 4. So we got left. Okay. This is important. Please note. Section 2. Suppose a local jurisdiction, let's say it's Shelby County, let's go for it. Okay. Makes election law changes, like say it changes the county commission election process that clearly will reduce minority voting rights in Shelby County. Let's make this up. What can you do now? Well, the affected voters can sue under Section 2. Section 2 is still in place, and it says you can go to court, and if you can prove, prove is an important thing in law, that the change will have the effect of reducing minority voting strength, then you can win, and they have to do it over again. Even more obscure and in place is Section 3. Section 3 permits a federal judge, federal district judge, if so persuaded by plaintiffs, to order a local jurisdiction to change if it's shown that their election law change was intended to disenfranchise, reduce minority voting. The only problem with Section 3, I've got to move on here, is that it's very hard to prove intent because people intend to do bad things, don't leave paper trails. And emails. And, yes. Unless the NSA is looking at them, we can get that later. Okay, now, with that in mind, we're in a situation where the U.S. Justice Department is now in court going after North Carolina and Texas for sure because they just jumped on the Shelby County decision. Let's go for it and, you know, mess around with election laws. So good luck with that. All this leads up to what we're looking at, which is the current situation, which doesn't affect Hispanic and Black American voters and Native American, everyone in this room, which is a general framework of laws governing all of us. Now, to get to that point, I want to, again, as I did in my class last year, recommend one of the classics in political science, V.O. Key's Southern Politics, published in 1949. Try to get it pretty cheap. You know, on Amazon or something. Now, Professor Key was a pioneer because he wrote a book, a very thick book. And most of this book is about, you know, all the details about Southern Democratic politics in the 30s and 40s, you know, who's who and so forth. But he has a whole section, on basically, it's called Restrictions in Voting. And there he details in great and sometimes black humorous length all the various ways the Southern states disenfranchised black people after Reconstruction in the 1860s and 70s. What were they? Well, the poll tax was the most famous one. Pay a tax in order to vote. That's gone because of a U.S. constitutional amendment. But there are various other ways. Make it really painful to register and vote. Make it really difficult. Make it strenuous. And now we're in 2014. We're back. That's not the South anymore. It's everywhere. Okay. Given the changing demographic composition of the potential United States electorate today, what is that? It's younger. It's less white. It's better educated. And given the demographic basis of the two major parties, you can see where I'm going with this. Okay, there are two ways to win elections. One is you go out and get more people to vote for you, right? You get more votes than the other side. Or you change rules so one side is disadvantaged in terms of getting its voters registered and voting. Number two is the option you're going to pick. Contemporarily today, the most obvious attempt to reduce the voting opportunities for certain types of voters are voter ID laws. You must show a required photo ID in order to register and vote. Okay, how do you get that? If you're poor, if you're a minority, you're in Alabama, Mississippi, you're Native American, in Big Horn County, let's run with that a bit. You go down there and say, I need to get a voter ID. Well, that's fine. Fill out this form. And by the way, that's $30, $20, whatever it's going to be. And you have to show us a certified notarized copy of your birth certificate or your passport or your naturalization papers. Have you got them? Have you don't? Okay, you have to get those. Well, I was born in California, unfortunately. I regret to say that because I've lived in Montana for 43 years and many of the states before that. But I am a native Californian. Forgive me. And if I wanted to copy my birth certificate, I actually tried to check that out. And, you know, you have to go on the website of San Diego County and go to blah, 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 find it, and they got to pay $30-$40 and they'll mail me the copy. And registration closes tomorrow. You can see where this is going. Now, many states said, oh my God, we didn't mean that. Mm-hmm. We'll take away the fee. You just have to show up with a birth certificate. Okay. And the point is that poor folks often don't have the ID that middle-class folks have.
Sure.
You know, that's the way it goes. Now you're saying, okay, I'm a student, right? I'm a student at some reputable university in some state. I'm not making this up. I've got a photo ID, and it's clear here. It says I'm a U.S. citizen on the night. I'm making this up. I'm just projecting an identification card. I'm a resident state, blah, blah, blah. I show up, and they say, what else you got? Because that's not valid. It's got my picture right on it. So it's a faculty ID. I got it right on it. We have to still get a birth certificate and get the official voter ID. And so in at least one state I'm aware of, student identification is an unacceptable form of ID, but a gun permit is. So let's all get gun permits. What the heck? Okay. Easy now. Another one. Those voter rolls, and that's true, the voter rolls especially often get kind of filled up with dead wood, literally in some cases. And other people moved away and so forth. So it's a good idea to clean out those election rolls. Of course, what you do it under the federal law is, of course, after a federal election, a county official is supposed to send out a postcard to every registered voter. You know, it's automatically returned if no one's there, and then you know they try to find if you're still there alive or not, and they can take you off. But Florida right now thought, well, that's not good enough, so they hired a private company to go out and go through the records of every registered voter in the state of Florida, about 7, 8, 9 million, something like that, and find any potential non-citizens. Well, 182,000 or so non-citizens showed up, and then they did some further winnowing and got down to 2,600. Then they sent the 2,600 to the county clerks and recorders. There are like 67 counties in Florida. And now we're down to 198 out of 7, 8 million people that may be non-citizens who voted. 98. Okay. Of that group, 190, that group, apparently 40 did vote illegally. Out of how many? I'm not sure about even the 40 who voted. They know they're registered. The classic example is the Bush Justice Department decided to do a nationwide data search for illegal voters about 2004, 2005, during the election. And they found 70. 70 nationwide who may have voted illegally. Of the 70 who voted illegally, most didn't even know they were illegal. Like a convicted felon gets out, thinks, I can go register to vote. Sure, register to vote and then votes. They didn't know they couldn't do it. No one told them. What the heck, you know? Final point. The National Voter Registration Act, enacted in 1993, has this. So what's the problem? When you register to vote, you sign an affidavit saying that you are a citizen. Of course, if you lie, then you can be, you know, prosecuted. Think logically, people. How many illegal aliens would actually do that? They're trying to hide out over here, you know, or else they get deported. They're not going to do that. They don't. More likely is some local political machine stuffing the ballot box. That's very common in American history, isn't it? Yeah? Okay. Restrict voting time and place. Okay, now we come to Montana. One of my favorite reforms was done in Minnesota, a great state, in 1974. They were the first state to adopt Election Day registration. Okay, you can show up on Election Day, show some ID, register, and vote on the spot. Yeah, substantial number of Minnesotans do that, especially young people. It's true. I did the research. Fact. My research showed that it had no partisan effect either way over several elections. The Democrats were not favored by the system, nor the Republicans. The only exception was Jesse Ventura. Jesse Ventura just cleaned the slate in those college towns he ran in 1998. They loved the guy. So, okay, there's the outrider, so to speak. Now, in the wake of Minnesota, several states, Wyoming, Idaho, blah, 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 have adopted election day registration. Now they're taking it back. Wisconsin took it back. And now we may have legislative referendum 126 on the ballot if the language of said referendum passed by the legislature is approved by the Attorney General. Right now, legislative referendum 26 is back to be rewritten because it says it is it is designed to go with the requirements of the National Voter Registration Act, which is a lie. What it does is it takes away election day registration in Montana and takes it back to Friday before the Tuesday.
Why would they do that?
Because there's a projection, contrary to any evidence over time that I would have, that it favors the Democrats. Who does that? Young people and so on. The classic statistic is in 2006, John Tester won, beat Conrad Burns by about 3,000 votes, give or take. The number of people walking in and voting under this new law, first using in 2006, is about 3,000. So, connection right there. No, there wasn't. That's just a fortuitous statistical anomaly, so to speak. Anyone can do this. Okay, now. 10 minutes, I got to stop. One other thing about messing with the voting. Here's another fun one. Two-tier voting systems. Some states, again in the South actually, have decided one way to get around any federal jurisdiction is to have their state elections and local elections under a separate day and separate system than the federal elections, so they don't have to comport with federal rules such as they exist. Texas is currently in court because they've been strenuously trying to pack Hispanic voters in the few districts in South Texas they possibly can, thus wasting their votes in adjacent districts. and the Justice Department's after him right now. And this is what Texas said. Oh, we're not discriminating against Hispanic voters under the Voting Rights Act, Title, you know, Section 3 and 4, 3 and 2. It's just a partisan thing. It's just, incidentally, it might be Democrats. They're Democrats. That's the important thing. We can do that. We can stuff Democrats in districts. If they're Hispanic, well, that's not important. Yeah. And that's a real whopper, as one election law professor said. We're in court. We need to really get back. I personally, and I'll leave it at that, I think the federal courts and the Supreme Court, this won't do it, but should revisit the whole idea of gerrymandering the second party into total, you know, powerlessness for every 10 years. That's almost Putinish, you might say. I'll use that term. Lastly, but not least, campaign finance laws. Okay, we've had a federal law governing who can give since 1907, with the passage of the Corrupt Practices Act under a Republican, Theodore Roosevelt, who thought it would be a grand idea to prohibit business corporations from giving money to candidates directly. You know, that sounds like a bit of a corrupting influence. And we've evolved over time, and in the wake of the Watergate scandal, which paper bills were in suitcases going to the Nixon campaign and the table, we got the Federal Election Campaign Act. And ever since, opponents of it have been whittling away at, now they've been really chopping it down with good effect. The law as it was enacted says, okay, corporations and unions and people can only give so much to a candidate, and they only give so much aggregate to a candidate and political party organizations each year. They also are required to disclose who they gave the money to, and candidates are obliged to report what they spent the money on. But here's the thing. In the 1976 Supreme Court decision ruling on the constitutionality of the Election Campaign Act, the court did something that I don't think the majority realized what they just did. They struck down the part of the law which limited expenditures by candidates, saying, well, a candidate should be able to spend as much money as he or she wants to get their point of view across. It's speech. Spending money is speech, said the court. I think Potter Stewart wrote that. And fine, okay. Well, it took a while for people to think about what that meant, but now we know what it means. Yes, money is speech. Okay. And it's been going on ever since. I'm just going to count the ways. The Supreme Court in the 1976 decision said direct contribution of a candidate is limited, but any money you spend over here on getting your point of view across is advocacy, issue advocacy. Boy, what a loophole that became. You know, by 2000, it was just running amok. You know, wealthy individuals, groups are spending tons of money in issue advocacy, saying everything it's a vote for, a vote against Joe Blow. They'd say nasty things about this person, this terrible person, but never say the magic words. One of the victims of that runaround is John McCain. So John McCain joined with Democrat Russ Feingold, and they did a little tweak with a lot of effort, God bless them, to fix that loophole. And they did. Say, okay, if you're spending money in a campaign, it's about candidates, we don't care what you say in the last 60 days of the general election. We'll just call it election donation. You have to say the limits. In other words, you can't alter claim you're just putting your point of view across. If it's 60 days for the election, you're talking about Joe Blow, then that's for against Joe Blow. That's a campaign contribution of the beneficiary, and you're under the limits so established. How do you get around that?
What year was that period?
2002 is when the law was enacted. Okay, so in the wake of that, the big money, as most of you know, flowed to so-called nonprofits, 501c4 accounts. Nonprofits are under the jurisdiction of the Internal Revenue Service, not the Federal Election Commission. A nonprofit means what it means on paper. You can spend money in politics as long as the majority of money you spend isn't in politics. And oh, by the way, since you're not really in politics, mostly, you don't have to tell us who the donors were to your political campaign spending. And so we have Karl Rove's group and the Cook brothers, Koch brothers, Cook, Koch. I live on Koch Street over here. Koch, I guess, is accepted pronunciation of these $100 billion brothers. Together, the top 10 richest individuals in the country, Koch combined them. So anyway, so that's where the money was going in 2010. And then the Supreme Court basically codified that in the Citizens United case. Okay. Here's something you need to know. I don't care what your political persuasion is. You should be really mad about this.
Yeah.
Okay. It involved a movie called Hillary Movie.
Oh, yeah.
It was a little documentary, a very negative little movie about Hillary Clinton, put together by this conservative group, Corporation, by the way. Corporation. It was on cable, and you had to pay for it, I think. It was never broadcast widely. And the Federal Election Commission said, "Ah, that looks like a political ad to me. That looks like advocate. That looks like a campaign spend. That looks like it comes under the McCain-Feingold new rules. You know, you can only spend so much." And so there we are. So I have to pull out comment on this one. So Citizens United goes for the U.S. Supreme Court. It's about the movie Theodore Olson, whose wife was killed in 9/11, one of those planes, who was in the Bush administration. I think he was Solicitor General at that time during 9/11. He's arguing for Citizens United. He goes for the Supreme Court, for John Roberts and the others, and said, "Look, this is an easy one. All you have to say, Supreme Court justices, it's a movie, it's not an ad, and we're done." He invited them to make a very narrow, non-significant decision, not even bring in the constitutionality of any part of federal campaign law. Just say, "Yeah, it's a movie." What the court did was an extreme act of judicial activism. They didn't do that. The Roberts Court invited the sides to come back months later and argue it again. They wanted to actually argue the constitutionality of federal campaign law. When you think about that, I mean, that's nasty, you know? We invite you to make a decision on behalf of our client and move on. No, we want to really swing for the bleachers on this one. Okay. So, Jeffrey Toobin, who is, among other things, the kind of staff writer for The New Yorker on legal issues and written several marvelous books, I recommend. He's a good writer. Toobin published an analysis of the Citizens United case in the May 21st, 2012 issue of The New Yorker called Money Unlimited. I'm sure you can Google that sucker and read the whole thing. It's good reading. He says, Justice Kennedy was the fifth and deciding vote on this issue. And Justice Kennedy, who at one time was thought until recently as a swing vote, could go either way, now goes one way. He quotes Kennedy. I was surprised to read this yesterday. Kennedy, writing for the court, said, "The court has recognized the First Amendment protection extended to corporations. This is true. This has been true since 1886, when speech, especially political speech, could not be impeded. The censorship we now confront is vast in its reach. The government has muffled the voices that best represent the most significant segments of the economy." That's his words. That's his words. "And the electorate has been deprived of information, knowledge, and opinion vital to its function. By suppressing the speech of manifold corporations, both for-profit and non-profit, the government prevents their voices and viewpoints from reaching the public and advising voters on which persons or entities are hostile to its interests." Conclusion: if the First Amendment has any force, it's Kennedy again, it prohibits Congress from fining or jailing citizens or associations of citizens for simply engaging in political speech. Now we've come full circle from the 1976 decision. Corporations are people. Why do we know that? Because in 1886, in an obscure case called, I think it was Southern Pacific Railroad versus the County of Santa Clara, California, the justice writing opinion had a throwaway sentence in the opinion saying, "Oh, by the way, corporations are people." We just threw it in there. It wasn't central to deciding that case. And here it comes back again and again and again and again. John Paul Stevens, who since retired and just wrote a book called On Amendments, was pretty upset about it, and he's a better spokesman for what's wrong with Kennedy's opinion than I am. his dissent. At bottom, the court's opinion is thus a rejection of the common sense of the American people, who have recognized a need to prevent corporations from undermining self-government since the founding, and who have fought against the distinctive corrupting potential of corporate electioneering since the days of Theodore Roosevelt. It is a strange time to repudiate that common sense. While American democracy is imperfect, few outside the majority of this court would have thought its flaws included a dearth of corporate money in politics, unquote. I have to come to a conclusion. We have now a decision in this term, Sean McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission. Sean McCutcheon is a wealthy individual in Alabama who thought, gee, I can only give so much aggregate to candidates and parties each election term, and that's not fair. I want to give more money. That's what he's saying. So what's his limit? $123,200 to candidates every 2 years. Okay. And $74,000 to various PACs and party organizations. I'm sorry, $48,600 to candidates and $74,600 to parties. $123,200. So Sean is saying, I can't spend more than $123,000 every 2 years in direct contributions to candidates, parties, and PACs I prefer. Gee, that's not fair. Supreme Court, 5-4 agreed. They agreed. Okay. How many people hit the maximum, 644 in the last election cycle? Out of how many million voters? If you count the people that max out in party donations, about 1,000. So we're talking about 1/10,000th of 1% of the voters are being disenfranchised by the Federal Election Campaign Act. So I quote, it's a good place to stop, actually. Justice Roberts in McCutcheon v. FEC, there's no right in our democracy more basic than the right to participate in electing our political leaders. There's no right more basic. More basic. People, would the framers of the Constitution in Philadelphia agree with that statement in 1787? There's no right more basic than the right of people to vote? They didn't want people voting. Actually, they're pretty conservative guys. You know, they were pretty scared of that. Bill of Rights? No? Okay. There's no right more basic than the right to participate in electing our political leaders. What's with Shelby County v. Holter then? Year before. When in fact, you're basically giving carte blanche to local, state and local official lawmakers to mess with the election laws with partisan intent, right? I'll stop right there. The South, back in the 1890s, the wake of Reconstruction, reimposed racial discrimination in voting and all parts of life. They did so knowing they had to make it legal, so they passed all these laws and conscience amendments and so forth and so on to make it all legal. Okay. Running in tandem with that was something else we're now back called the Gilded Age. Extreme concentration of wealth in a very small number of families and individuals. This data is irrefutable. So we're kind of back to the 1890s in some odd sort of ways, aren't we? And so the remedy for that, of course, was political, ultimately, which was elect new leaders, new parties, and so forth and so on. And then we got some laws, and here we are. That's difficult. I'll stop. Questions, comments? Yes.
When you do census, you know, and that, are they talking just the people that can vote? I mean, because I have 8 kids. How do they base that number?
The districting question? It's based on the total population, all people, men, women, children, citizens, non-citizens, everyone that's counted. That's in the Constitution. You want to change it, you've got to amend the U.S. Constitution. It says all people shall be counted every 10 years. And that's the basis of...
But that's how the basis
of
the district.
Now, your question is a good one because there's some discussion in some of these same state legislatures to say maybe we can restrict the right to vote to only... Maybe count the census, only count citizens. Well, yeah, you can do that, but the 14th Amendment says count all people. It says count all people. So you have to amend the Constitution to do that. And let's say you actually pull this off. How are you going to count them?
And by the way, how do you not count children and other dependents who are part of all the other data we have that involves the distribution of federal programs and you name it, you know, it's what's the word you're thinking of? It's a solution, search for problem. There are easier ways, not judgment, to discourage people from voting.
And could I follow a second? Why don't we just have the computer do the district lines?
It's garbage in, garbage out, your return. Whatever goes in may be totally wrong. Good example is Florida. You know, Florida said, okay, you know, they hired a private company to do this data search. And boy, they didn't know what they're doing. You know, and classic example, this data search through computer analysis, you know, comparing stuff, flagged two county officials, two county clerks and recorders, illegal voters. And I'm not making that up. Little old lady. What? And also a member of Congress, by the way.
But it wouldn't work if where you just had 1,000 votes or however it is, and then have it just go out a certain distance on each, and they're nice square lines.
That would be sweet.
It didn't matter.
Now, in Montana, the rules governing reapportionment are make them as equal to population as required, plus or minus 3%, and that's the basic rule. Then it says also in the statute you can try to follow the contours of established lines like rivers and counties, but you have to stay in the 3%. So you can have, you know, you have to be, you know, that way. But, yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah, have there been any studies on how effective all these corporate expenditures have been, or studies that indicate how much tilts toward one party versus the other?
Well, in terms of simply the data, in terms of the money, the Republicans clearly get the largest share of money, direct contributions, and direct support, and so on. Your first question is interesting, how effective is it? Okay, not very, considering all the money has been spent in the last couple elections. And this is because the money was spent on what we call wholesale politics, spending tens and tens of millions of dollars on television and radio ads that carpet bomb the listener and viewer. It has no effect. It actually probably decreases overall voter turnout, that negativity gets to you after a while. So no one's stupid here, because the Koch brothers, for example, spend a lot more money now on hiring bright young things to go out door to door, street by street, to register voters. That's a much more effective way to spend your money. Democrats actually have a leg up in that area because they have less money. But now the other side's presumably catching up. The only problem is the whole demographic shift over time.
You might be able to identify all your current Republican voters, but they're going to be increasing minority unless you increase your base by appealing with a broader message than simply, we don't like you, we don't want you to vote, message, in my opinion.
I was wondering about, everyone's concerned about this big money coming in and buying our government, and how difficult it is to find out who it is and where their money is being spent. Mm-hmm. And is it possible, say, there's a group called Follow the Money, mm-hmm. where we can find out how much the Koch brothers and their compatriots?
I think you could. Get
some money?
I think you could, but I'm just going to give you my seat-of-the-pants opinion here. Better time spent in mobilizing your political base. Register every person you can find who's going to go your way and make sure they get to the polls. That'll defeat most of that junk every time. And by the way, who knows what happened with the America's Traditions Partnership?
Yeah. It's disappeared.
Pissed off a lot of Republican legislators. And they led the fight to get to go after these guys. Who was next?
Yeah. With the shifting demographics, I've heard that Texas and Georgia might shift to the Democratic side. Is that going to happen anytime soon?
Well, the demographics especially are going the Democrats' way. But then again, the counter proposal is you have two choices. You try to keep those people away, which in a short time might work given the Supreme Court's tilt. Or you could actually go back to where, in my judgment, the Republican Party was when I was growing up. actually a major party with a broad base of support for the conservative message, but not a crazy message. You know, who's against fiscal conservative? I'm not for keeping your money and, you know, being fiscally responsible. And back in those old days, when I started to vote, the Republican Party was for civil rights and all this stuff, you know, for the most part. Hey, you know, and the Republican, quote, establishment knows this. They know that the strategy of narrowing your base and restricting the vote is a loser in the long term. Hence, they're trying to, they're searching for the right candidate who it is to run for president. Starts with B.
Laws about the number of polling places
of district casting. As to that, I don't know it. That's another way you can do shenanigans, so to speak.
Well, you can restrict voting by hardly any polling.
Well, Ohio in 2004, the Secretary of State office, which was held by the Republicans, did that. They reduced the number of voting booths in high minority districts and high turnout districts, so it was raining all day, like it is right now. It did reduce turnout, that was intentional. Here's the other thing, I'm glad you asked the question, because you made me remember what I just forgot, which is happens a lot. And that is, all this talk about we've got to stop voter fraud, no evidence of that. All this talk about routinizing and regularizing and all this stuff, all this hoo-ha about, gee whiz, some illegal alien might vote or something like that. Guess what? You heard any complaints about absentee voting from that group? For people that want to have voter ID laws? No, you haven't heard a word. And what the heck? You know, why? Because people vote absentee, or people in this room.
Yeah.
Older, lighter. Huh? You know?
Oregon has had, you know, mail-in voting for about, what, six elections now, give or take? Gee, where's the fraud? Where's the outrage? I mean, some cult could organize its cultists and, you know, do it. What's going on here? It's all political. You know, that's fine. Let's recognize it for what it is. You know, some of this, I've got a heck of a deal for you. You know, watch out. That's true in politics. Yes.
Well, everything is just so upsetting, but I'm at least kind of happy about the court decisions that have been coming down on against voter ID laws, and they're saying this is unconstitutional. This will restrict the rights of people to vote. And so, I mean, it's really clear what states like Wisconsin, where I'm from, and North Carolina, I believe, was just recent.
Yeah.
They're adopting unconstitutional, you know, acts on purpose.
You still have to go to court and have to sue.
You do.
Yeah. A state court just struck down for a second time a Pennsylvania ID law. And now the governor of Pennsylvania said, yeah, I know him. And he says, I'm going to give up now. I'll wait for the next election and make another run at it. Yeah, but it takes time and money and lawyers and all kinds of things. It's hard work trying to get your voting rights.
Yeah.
Now, you're not a black person in the South in 1962, and they'll lynch you for it.
Yeah.
But still, yeah.
This is dangerous territory in a room with several historians. If we read the Federalist Papers and the arguments between Madison, Hamilton, and Jefferson, they were arguing over whether the country should be a plutocracy or a democracy. Mm-hmm. And it seems that just about all the decisions that you've mentioned in your talk favor plutocracy.
Yeah,
and I'm wondering if, in fact, you know, and I've been trying to find common threads through all the arguments of conservative justices. And I'm wondering if, in fact, when Scalia and Roberts and others talk about originalism, they don't mean pre-constitutional America, reflected a century later in the Gilded Age, a country run by people with money and vested interests.
Well, let me answer it this way. Of course the framers of Philadelphia were plenty of men. Only one or two ordinary farmers were among all those delegates. Okay, you know that. And so there was a strong tilt. Hamilton leading the charge in the direction we're talking about. We should let you know what the people. And there was Madison, bless him. Truly the father of this Constitution was so politically savvy, he said, you can't do that. You know, it won't fly. We have to get the states to approve it. we have to make some gestures for a popular sentiment about paraphrasing. We've got to go there. But certainly Madison, all of them, did not envision the mass electorate as desirable. Yeah. And of course they didn't, they were mostly slave owners too. Think about that, guys.
Excuse me. Water. And so I guess my answer, sir, is that, you know, I love the Constitution, I love the framers, I studied them deeply. I was very lucky that they were around at that time. Too bad the Syrians, too bad the Syrians don't have some people like them now, or any other number of people in the world. They don't have a core of leaders who were smart but politically savvy. Roberts is smart but not politically savvy. Scalia, and the people we mentioned, and they fit the bill of one legal scholar said, there are two ways to look at how the Supreme Court decides and judges decide cases. One is the one you taught in law school. I went to law school. Here's the law up here, the stellar principles. We have these principles, these precedents up here, and then we look at the facts and we line up the facts with the principles and then out pops an almost automatic decision. That's the typical point. Or, which is the one I adhere to, judges have a gut feeling about how it should go and then go look for the right precedent and leave the principles just on what they're going to decide. I mean, I think a quote was from a New Hampshire Supreme Court justice a century ago. I never failed to find the principles in the law that would justify what I wanted to do. And when John Roberts says, those precious things, the right, you know, if that were true, you'd be on the side in Shelby, lots of other cases, you know? Yeah.
Following up on that, as some time goes by, from a historical perspective, what is your guess as to what legal scholars will say about the Supreme Court?
Jeffrey Toobin has written a couple books already. You can start with him. He's kind of a legal scholar. The Nine is one, and the other one, I forgot the name of it.
Anthony Lewis.
Is he, what's the name of that, you know?
Anthony Lewis, you know.
Yeah, he used to do that, too. I don't want to guess on that. I think the outlier in this whole discussion is the Roberts' decision on the Affordable Care Act. He wrote, he said it's good to go.
Yeah, yeah.
But you notice what he did. He didn't base it on the Commerce Clause, which it is. On some other part, taxing, I think, was enough. Yes. And so he left himself wiggle room to come back and go after it later. So here's the other thing, too. What we also know is that the president will have no opportunity whatsoever to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court in the last 2.5 years. You know that. You know, the votes won't be there. And so as this is not new. Congress, when you get toward the end of the presidential term, will often just stall it. You know, wait for the election. And so we'll see who comes up. But the Supreme Court, with all of its flaws, in my judgment, its judgment, if you like, is still a great, great idea. I think you look at the course of American history with some major road bumps like Dred Scott. It's done a pretty good job of elevating individual rights over temporary political expediency.
The book is called The Oath, The Obama Years on the Supreme Court.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Is that the 9 or that's the new book?
That's the 2012. I'm looking for the new one. I went to the library. I've got to provide this information, right? It's The Oath, The Obama White House on the Supreme Court. It was 2002. And then you said he has a new one out?
Well, it's called the 9, I think. Is it? Anything else, Rod? One last question.
My understanding is that Clarence Thomas has also opened the door to taking away any limit of any kind on amounts of money that go to a single candidate in his.
Concurring
little statement that he put in.
Yeah, he put out a concurring opinion in McCutcheon, which I didn't read. I'm sorry, he's not one of my favorite authors, but I think you're right.
He was questioning why there should be any sort of inviting the next.
Well, it's not happening. James Bopp, who's one of the leaders of the conservative lawyer clique that is pushing all these changes, he's already going to court and challenging that. And you're going to win.
I know
they're going to win.
So on the independent expenditures, could they could there be a law that would require you to name your donors?
Yes, that'd be good.
Yeah. Or is that just a matter of Congress?
Yes.
We are the people. We talk about the Supreme Court and its political nature. That's a reflection of the people. Because what a political process it is when each of these folks is elected. I mean, that is the point. So, you know, we got what we deserve, I guess.
No.
No.
No, because we all, I think, I'm really mad at all those voters that got me to where I got now. Didn't go my way, but that's the way it goes. Yeah. So my answer is get more of my side out to vote and so forth. And that's the point. It doesn't look good for Democrats this year, and that's true of any party that in this thing, when the president, in every election since they started collecting data, the president's party always loses seats in Congress in the off year. Every election. Because the turnout drops by 1/3. And the voters who do show up in 2014, 2008 will end up being whiter, older, more conservative. Again, you can beat that, but you have to do some serious voter mobilization to get there. So that's the way it goes. The other thing I mentioned, because I noticed this, I'm noticing, and someone can add to this if they know more than I do, I'm noticing that candidates are asking for more money than individuals are used to now. Someone says the end of bake sales and so forth and cookie raffles and whatever, it's big money now. So you figure Walsh and Danger are spending, what do you think, 10, 12, 14 million bucks? Them and their allies, at least?
Oh, jeez.
Something like that. You better get out of here.
No, I'm just going to drop this in the back.
Okay. Oh, we better stop. Thank you very much.
Thank you.